Coming up on today's Real Estate Realities, the segment of the market that's actually losing value. So stay right there for the rest of the show.
You are about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
What do you seem to understand? I'm not locked in here with you.
That's it!
You're locked in here with me!
Hello, everyone! And welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, member of the National Association of Realtors. Please don't hold that against me. Another day, another show. Today's show is a little bit creepy. I've got a couple of articles on the same thing. So the topic is fixed. We're not covering more than one thing, but I've just got a variety of pieces of evidence to cover. I don't want to call it evidence. It's not like I'm in the middle of a trial here. I need to prove something. But let's talk a little bit about some things I've said in previous shows. When it comes to the market, it seems that what everyone wants to say is we want to go back to the way it was. And invariably what they're talking about is that period of time from 2000 to 2007 or 8, when everything was nuts. But we don't. That's like saying I want to go back to just before the Titanic hit the iceberg, but too late to change the course. The problems that really set in for us, or the things that really caused us our problems, were in effect for a long time. And a lot of people made really silly decisions, I guess, that made sense at the time. Money was cheap. Rates were low. Rates are still ridiculously low. And so When we're celebrating that prices are where they were at the peak, maybe we need to be a little bit more worried, because remember, we've been at that peak before. Everyone wants to remember the peak. No one wants to remember what came right after the peak. And I think you can make a very rational argument that the prices that we saw at and leading up to the peak were artificially created. They were ridiculously high. And people will say, well, you know, that was 10 years ago, so, you know, reaching it now is more normal. Well, it's not. In both cases, we've got a lot of weird artificial things sort of feeding the process, right? I love it when some people say, well, we got to let the system work, right? Well, that we're not really using the system that's really worked for us in the past, right? We're in this situation where there's a lot of different fingers in the pie, right? Ranging from the Fed and interest rates to federal policies that encourage one action over the other, and Fannie and Freddie and all these other wonderful things. So it's concerning to me when there's a celebration of the fact that we're back at peak numbers. Now, a good example of that, there's a couple of articles here I've got, from one from WolfStreet.com and a couple of others from HousingWire, that are just a little bit concerning. Here's an excerpt from that article. The median home price had hit the all-time crazy peak of $230,000 in 2006. During the insane housing bubble that had such dramatic consequences when it imploded, So in May, the median price was almost back where it had been during that all-time crazy peak in 2006, just $1,300 off. Surely in June, and we don't yet have the numbers for June, the record will fall and a series of new all-time crazy records will be set. In a number of cities, insane records are already being set month after month, but no way that this is a housing bubble this time. He's attempting to say sarcastically. Now, I've talked a bit before about banding. I occasionally will get another real estate agent that makes fun of me for talking about banding, for talking about focusing on how real estate performs in different price bands. And what I have discovered with this other with a research item from Weiss Residential is that they've been doing the same thing but calling it something else. A really good example, there was a property that recently sold here in my town. It had been on the market for 670-something days. It sold just very recently, within the last month, for over $1 million lower than asking price. Now, it was already at 3.7-something. It ended up selling for 2.6-something. And I get that there's a huge segment of folks out there that are not going to shed a tear for someone who is dealing with selling or buying properties at that price point. But let's think about that for a second. That's a gigantic cut. Now, I always thought that home was overpriced, to be honest. I actually have a very good friend who lives on the street, lives right across the street from the home. I've shown properties on that street before. It is very much a stratosphere purchase kind of thing. These are estates. These aren't working ranches. These tend to be just 2 acres or less. So we're absolutely talking about folks who have lots of money. Most of these folks tend to be CEOs, maybe someone who is an early investor in PayPal, or, I could rattle off a few company names, but there are some folks in there who are very successful in the business world who are buying homes that reflect that kind of success. They're willing to take certain business risks and they bought a home. That segment is getting its butt kicked right now. And I'm seeing that in a lot of different areas. And I say that, and I'll get people calling me nuts, and they'll point to certain places where that's not happening. And I'll nod my head and say, well, yeah, in that local marketplace, the price banding is different, right? Someone wants to point to Palo Alto. And I haven't actually looked at Palo Alto numbers in a while. I wouldn't mind looking at them and seeing what's happening. Now, the equivalent of a $2 to $3 million house from Morgan Hill would be a $6 or $7 or an $8 million house from Palo Alto. So that's my example, right? The price banding of a high-end home in Palo Alto would be something at that higher level. So it'd be interesting to see how things are performing there. But if we look at these general numbers, it's just very interesting that everyone seems to take so much comfort from this idea that we're at the peak. We shouldn't be happy about that. We should be concerned. A lot of the same dynamics that were in play then are in play now. Again, quoting from Wolf Street, home sales have been hot by post-financial crisis standards. According to the National Association of Realtors, sales of new homes rose to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 546,000 in May, fastest pace since February of 2008. The pending home sales index hit the highest level since April 2006. Existing home sales rose 9.2% from a year ago and a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 5.35 million. The fastest pace since November of 2009, and the median price of existing homes jumped 7.9% to $228,700, the highest since 2006. And we were just talking about that number a minute ago. And everyone wants to call this, like Equifax, describe this as a booming year for mortgage origination growth. Total mortgage origination balances jumped 74% year over year in the first quarter to $466 billion. First lien mortgage balances soared 80% to $430 billion. The number of mortgages originated in the first quarter jumped 55% to 1.78 million, and average loan amounts rose 12% to $232,547. Now, we already talked about HELOCs several days ago when we talked about the next – what I thought was a major contributor to the next bubble. I think that it is. I think it's just one of several things. Home equity lines of credit rose 30% to $31 billion, with new accounts up 21% to 285,700, the highest since 2008. The average credit limit rose 9% in March to $108,533. And finally, new home equity installment loans rose 14% to $5 billion. New loans originated in the first quarter jumped 20% to more than 142,800. Now, this is all recent. This is all just happening, right? This is all first quarter of this year. These are ridiculous increases. We have jumped, or a huge segment of our society has jumped back into indebtedness like it's a party. You would think a lot of these folks simply don't remember what it was like after the last peak. A lot of this has to do with the fact that mortgage rates have been at near historic lows, but the Fed says they're going to raise them. Now, most other folks disagree with me and believe that the Fed will raise them. I believe they will eventually, but it will be with a gun pointed to their head where they have no choice. The Fed has shown so far that when it comes to these kinds of decisions, they're really about protecting the stock market. And if they raise interest rates, the stock market will suffer. Stock market is already in trouble. For those of you who keep track of it, stock market's not doing well over the last couple of days. There are bad things happening. Almost everything was negative. The only stock I track – I have several stocks I track, but the only one I could see that was up today was Google. There's things going on in China. Ridiculously scary. Big bubble bursting in China. The things go on in Greece. There's and remember, and I know, and this is unfortunately, if you're going to look at what's going to poke our economy with a stick down the road, you have to look outside of our borders. I realize this is not sexy stuff. I'm not going to be drawing in tons of listeners by talking about some of the most boring stuff on the planet, and that's what a lot of this stuff is. But Greece is super bad news. Greece is that kid you see in the supermarket who throws a tantrum because his mom won't buy him a candy bar. He wants that candy bar. He deserves that candy bar. He shouldn't have to work for that candy bar. But the difference is that kid now expects all the people in the supermarket with him to pay for him to have a candy bar. And what's amazing is that's the political wind in the country, is to resist this idea that we need to tighten our belts and spend less. I guess based on the idea that the Greek folks feel like they were promised this stuff by their government, but that's kind of the way things go when you have a government that says they're going to provide you with everything. It doesn't work. I'm not sure why we have to replay this one over and over again, because we'll do it different. It never is different, never has been. Everyone's tried it going all the way back to the freaking Romans. It just doesn't work. Why people don't learn this lesson, I don't know. But here we are again. There appears to be no politician that doesn't believe any item is too small, that it won't benefit from their manipulation. And we always end up with these kinds of scenarios where with probably the best of intentions, we just slowly create this huge tower that is bound and determined to fall on our heads. Let's cover some of these other numbers that I thought were interesting. Over the decades, mortgage rates have declined with some mini surges in between. If we go all the way back to 1980, that looks like about 1983 or 4. Interest rates were at 17.5. I've told this story before about how when interest rates went below 10%, everyone freaked. And I had a long list of properties I was considering as investments for myself in 1990. And some of them have been on the market for a year, 2 years, and suddenly interest rates went below 10%, and that happened right around – it dipped below 10 and then went back up. But during that little dip below 10%, all of those properties sold over a weekend. It was crazy, and people are very keyed into interest rates. But what's crazy now is people are less – tuned in to the idea of them going up. They've been going steadily down. You could make an argument that they were a little bit more wacky in the 80s, but they still generally were down. They started the decade up around 17%, ended the decade right around 10%. And then during the 90s, continued that drop, not as steep. We kind of started the decade right around 10%, kind of ended the decade right around 7.5%. And then from, 2000 to 2010, it went from about 7.5% down to 5%. And we've really been below 5% ever since. What I find interesting is if you plot into that graph, and you know what? I think I can actually do that. Can I do that? I believe I can. If you're watching this, yes. Yes, I can, and I've done it. So well, there you go. Magic is happening. The graph is now actually up as part of the show feed. So if you're watching this on therebelbroker.com, you can see in the video portion, or you should be able to see in the video portion, the graphic image that I'm referring to right now. And the gray bars represent downturns or mini bubbles, or you know, so the one right around 2000 was the stock collapse, the tech bubble, and then the other gray area towards creeping up towards 2010 is the bubble we just saw. And you look at what happens there, and it's not that big of a drop, but look, interest rates continue to go down, and we've been holding them down here artificially for quite a while. And this article goes on to say, as the Fed approaches liftoff, and this is one I am personally taking this one with a grain of salt, so take that for what it's worth. Possibly as soon as this September, we are approaching the beginning, quote, we are approaching the beginning of the end of the era of falling mortgage rates and entering a period in which rates are likely to rise over the next several years. And that's from a Zillow analyst or analysis. And they go on to say that decades-long tailwind will likely shift to a housing headwind. So let's go ahead and assume they're correct, right? Now, if the Fed does start raising interest rates, it's not going to be a big increase. It's going to be a very mild increase. In other words, if we're currently hovering at around 4%, and I just confirmed that on MarketWatch, I'm seeing us being right around 4%. 30-year fixed rate is up to 4.04. 15 years up to 3.15. 1 year is up to, these are all fixed rates, are up to 2.7. Jumbo 30-year is at 4.31. 30-year FHA is down to 3.85. 5-1 adjustable rate is down to 3.13. And 5-1 jumbo ARM is up to 3.85. So right around 4% is where things tend to be hovering right now. My guess would be that that would tend to go up a little. It would tend to go up 4.1. It would tend to go up 0.1 or 0.2. And what you would do is probably each quarter you would see a small increase of that type. Here's the concern though, right? Folks who watch this stuff will be thinking in their heads, well, where will this stop? Where will interest rate increases stop? Because remember, this is about managing where your money goes. And as I've argued before, another side effect of this is for every little piece of interest that we increase here in the United States, the attractiveness of having your money here, invested here, goes up, right? One problem we've had is that tons of the money that was sort of just dumped into the marketplace during this bubble or after this bubble. I mean, we've printed trillions of dollars. Most of it has gone to Europe because interest rates were higher there. And with all the crazy stuff we're seeing going on, whether we're talking about Greece, which is the poster boy for government ineptitude in terms of how one runs itself, you have to remember that there are plenty of countries not far behind. We're talking about Italy, Spain, France. There's a lot of bad floating around over there, and a whole lot of our monetary policy involved doing it in a way that drew a lot of that money over to Europe. One wonders what will happen when that money leaves Europe. As soon as we see interest rates go up in the United States, with each increase, another chunk of American money will come back, or another chunk of dollars will come back. You know, there's plenty of obstacles to bringing money back to the U.S. If you're a corporation, to repatriate it, we have the most ridiculous taxes in the world. So, you know, interest rates would have to sort of overcome to some degree that. But that doesn't apply to a lot to these investment strategies, right? There's a difference between a corporation repatriating money they've made overseas to the United States and investment consortiums moving money from A to B because there's a better rate of return. And never forget that phrase. It's about the rate of return. And depending on how much risk you're willing to take determines where you're going to put that money for the rate of return. You may get a ridiculous rate of return at place A, but if place A is losing its mind, but place B will make you a little bit less, but it's more sane, then where do you put that money? And it, the disparity between those two things is what help defines where those folks will put that money. And I think that for the on a global scale, the U.S. is seen as less crazy. But right now, the real rates are so low that it just doesn't even make sense. So they've been putting it – trying to put it into things that made some sort of sane sense in Europe, which is becoming less sane all the time. But with a higher enticing interest rate in the U.S., that money is going to come back. And more dollars circulating in the United States equals a dollar in your pocket that's not worth as much tomorrow as it was today, right? If the volume of dollars goes up, the value of the dollar in your pocket goes down. So if you can buy a loaf of bread today with the dollar in your pocket by bringing dollars back into our marketplace, it'll now cost you – that $1 will now only buy you 80% of a loaf of bread. You see what I mean? That's the theory behind that. Okay, this goes on to discuss some other things. I'm skipping over some of the not important stuff. Real estate is local, so prices vary. In San Francisco, something peculiar has been happening. Since January of 2012, the median price for all types of homes has shot up 107%, according to Paragon Real Estate Group's June 2015 report, now 42% higher than during the peak of the prior all-time crazy bubble. Does that sound reassuring? Does that remember, we're talking about numbers that are now higher than the peak. I don't get comfort from that. It doesn't make sense to me in a normal marketplace. If we decided we were already overpriced because things had gotten screwed with, because we had created far too many buyers by embracing subprime lending, right? We artificially created more buyers by saying, despite the fact you don't make enough money to pay back this loan, despite the fact you're not even giving me full documentation on your current income, it was widely done, no doc loans were common, despite the fact you were borrowing 110%, all these crazy things that were going on, we understood that those values weren't real. That peak wasn't real. It wasn't a peak of real value in real estate. It was a peak artificially created because you couldn't increase the number of homes on the market, but you could increase the number of buyers, which increased demand. So instead of having one person per two or three homes for sale, you had 50 people for each two or three homes for sale. And that just creates a feeding frenzy, right? And that's what caused prices to go up. We're seeing the same thing now. And we're seeing this – we've already talked about the level of indebtedness that everyone is jumping to. And we're going to get to some very interesting data here in a moment, I promise. But this is stuff that should scare you. The median house price, not home price, and by that we exclude condos and tenants in common and all that kind of stuff – Just townhomes and condos, don't worry about that, has shot up 96% since January of 2012. So for a house, for a single-family residential home, that house price has shot up 96% since January 2012 to reach $1,360,000 in May. Condos have hit a median price of $1,142,500. This is my local market. This is San Francisco. Just how crazy has San Francisco's market become? A chart of home prices going back to 1971, it compares San Francisco median house prices to the median house prices of existing homes in California nationwide. And then for this article, they circled in red housing bubble one and what we're calling housing bubble two. I'm going to go ahead and put this one up as well. I will think that you will find it ridiculously interesting and a bit scary. You do want to see that. You're going to need to be, again, watching the show on the Rebel Broker website. It's embedded into the M4A. I'm pretty sure that if you're watching it on an iPhone, you know, depending on the device you're watching it on, you may be able to see the little graphical image. There may be – if you usually see my yelling face on there, it won't happen when hosted on Blog Talk Radio. I know that for a fact because it gets changed to an MP3 and all you get is a poster frame of MP3, which is my beautiful screaming face. So right now, since my feed is not being fed yet by the Rebel Broker website, it's being fed by Blog Talk Radio. If you're watching this in iTunes or Stitcher or you're using the normal RSS feed, you're not going to see the additional graphics. You'll have to go to the website. I'm sorry for that. We're in that transitionary phase where I'm getting the system set up to transition, but I haven't transitioned over yet. So if you want to see those, you can head on over to the website and view the show there, or you can head on over to wolfstreet.com and take a look at this article entitled "San Francisco versus America in the Housing Bubble 2." But the numbers are staggering. It's so ridiculous. It's such a clear trend. In terms of comparing San Francisco, California, and U.S., the medians, and seeing how they slope and move and snake, and then seeing the similarities, and how this doesn't scare the crap out of a lot more people, kind of confuses me. Let's see. The median household income in San Francisco is not six times higher than in the U.S., which is what the house price is. It's the median household income is $77,700. In the U.S., it's $51,900. Incomes are 50% higher. Home prices are nearly 500% higher. U.S. housing industry is still talking about the market not having fully recovered yet. And as I point out, when they talk about fully recovered, they're talking about the crazy times when we were in a market that was out of its freaking mind. So always remember that. Whenever someone talks about getting back to numbers like they were in 2005 and 2006, they are talking about standing on the deck of the Titanic as we're hitting the iceberg. That's where they want to be standing. That's what they're pining for. This time hoping that somehow they can sustain it and prevent a catastrophe. And my argument would be that they haven't ever been able to yet. So why expect them to this time? Let's see. California overall still not quite back at the tippy top of housing bubble one, as some of the areas have been shameful laggards in this craziness. But the national median price of existing homes is only 3% below where it was during the craziest days of housing bubble one, and the industry is hopeful to breach the old record soon. Housing bubble two has shifted the dynamics, with the sweet spot moving ever higher on the pricing scale. During the first 5 months of this year in San Francisco, a total of 1,941 homes were sold, but only 51 were in the under 500,000 price range, or about 2.6% of all sales. You don't even want to know what less than 500,000 buys in San Francisco, and only 342 homes of all types, or 17.6% of total sales, were in the under $750,000 price range. Let that one sink in a little bit. Let's see. Is there anything else sexy here? San Francisco, while extreme, isn't the only city with this kind of pricing insanity. It fits neatly into the central bank scheme of inflating all asset prices into absurdity on a global scale. 5-year government bonds in Europe that have soared to such levels that yields have become negative. Chinese stocks that have lost all connection to reality. And median home prices that have moved far beyond the reach of the median household income. But in San Francisco, we know how to deal with this, riding this wave while we can, as far as we can, for as long as we can, because we know it's not going to last. So there you have it, right? And so what we end up with isn't critical thought about where we are and where we're going, but rather a celebration that we somehow find ourselves here. You know, and this is one thing that annoys me immensely, right? So I've mentioned before I like to work with veterans, and maybe there's a guilt syndrome mixed into that desire. You know, after all, they volunteered to go and go to dangerous places and do dangerous things on behalf of my country with the idea that they're doing that because they're serving the rest of us. And who knows? I'm not going to question the motivations of any one of them. They volunteered to go. I didn't. I was able to stay fat and happy at home while they went off and did things. So I like trying to work with those folks. Now, I have a client right now who can afford a home for $230,000. How many homes do you suppose I found that they could buy for $230,000, given the numbers I just told you that happened here in the Bay Area? Now, granted, that's San Francisco, which is the epicenter of stupid. It still boggles me that people will pay those kinds of prices for homes where people on the street are literally urinating on their properties. They have to, the city's talking about building materials they're going to start using that are urine resistant. Sorry, I ran across that piece of news today and I just had to share it. So now let's get to the Weiss Residential Report that lays into it. We're starting to see a little bit more of this being spoken out loud in other outlets. And this one's from Housing Wire, but this was pretty widely reported by a bunch of different places. And the subtitle of this one is, well, let's give you the whole title. Weiss Residential, nearly half of homes in top markets are losing value. And the subtitle is, here's where the next housing crash will start. This one is nuts. It very much ties together a lot of the things that we've talked about in this show over the last year. You know, I was kind of projecting flatness. I was projecting stagnation, probably. I had deep, dark concerns that we might be creating another scenario where everything goes boom. This was a year ago, though. If I look back on what's happened over this last year and looking at the charts that I've been talking about, I think it's absolutely reasonable to be ridiculously concerned about what's going to happen with the market over the next year. This article starts with, despite market reports of strong median home price appreciation this spring, gains are very uneven in nearly half of homes in 10 of the nation's largest markets actually lost value in May, according to a report by Weiss Residential Research's indexes. Now, this is from today. This is Monday, July 27th is when this came out. And again, I can – earlier in this show, we talked about what I've been discussing in terms of price banding and how – and that's what this is. This is identifying segments of the marketplace where things aren't going great. Everyone's been talking about this universally great, wonderful market for everyone, and it's just not – it's not the truth. It's not the reality that I've been able to see just from poking around with some numbers. Now, on a house-by-house basis, about one-third fewer homes in the largest markets gained value during the heart of the spring buying season this year compared to last year. Only 54% of homes in the markets appreciated during May compared to 81% in 2014. Let me repeat that. So just about half the homes in the market appreciated during May in 2015. In May of 2014, 81% did. So back a year ago, you could make the argument this is a relatively broadband recovery of prices or increase of prices. Today, you can't do that. Today, almost half the homes in the marketplace are excluded from that appreciation. Now, that's a sign that the downward trend may continue in the coming months. In Denver, the hottest market in the nation, 84% of houses appreciated in May compared to 95% last year. In the Washington, D.C. market, weakest of the top 10, only 34% of houses gained value in May compared to 57% in May of 2014. So in all these major marketplaces, fewer homes are enjoying an increase in value. Alan Weiss, the founder and CEO of Weiss Residential Research, was quoted as saying, "Don't be fooled by averages. All of the largest metro indexes are rising more slowly than they were a year ago, though market reports give the impression that values are rising across the board. However, people don't own the entire market. They own one house." So it just depends on where you your house is in that marketplace. And this is a reality that we've discussed on this show, not quite in these terms, but we've discussed how at the higher price points, because these tend to be higher price point homes, larger homes are having a harder time than smaller homes with two bedrooms or less. An example is Denver. Larger homes appreciated 5.8% on a year-over-year basis in May compared to smaller homes. In Washington, D.C., larger homes actually fell 0.7%. Smaller homes declined less, 0.2% over the year. Now, in a metro area like Washington, with a median price increase of 1.2% in the past year, according to the Case-Shiller Index, 60% of the houses are rising and the other 40% are stagnant or falling. Since the ones that are appreciating outnumber the ones falling, the average is a low positive number. So by using these averages, you're ignoring huge sections because it's not a broad spectrum increase or decline. When you – and that's exactly what I've been telling you to do. A couple of shows ago I said for – I think I even posted this one up on both Blog Talk Radio and on the website. Price banding was right there in the title. It talked about look for interesting things happening based on price. This is an interesting thing happening based on price in terms of how much – how much have the average price increased – or the average sales price increased or decreased, right? And this banding is what's showing us that there are very big weak spots in our marketplaces. Now, quoting Weiss, "Today, conditions at the local level may not be as positive as national reports indicate. Every house is unique, has a unique value, and responds differently to market changes. In today's market, sellers should price their homes very carefully and research local conditions to avoid overpricing that could lead to an extended time on market in case prices do decline. In this climate, buyers and investors should be careful to avoid buying a home that is on the verge of losing value." And then there's actually some data provided here in a nice little chart. It's ranked by percent of housing rise, or what numbers of homes, the percentage of the homes that actually increased. Denver's number one with 84%. San Francisco's number two with 65%. Seattle's number three with 62%. So that's the percent of homes that actually increased over the last year. Miami's at 59. Atlanta's 57. That's the top five, and we're at 57%. Just over half the homes showed an increase. In Chicago, it was only 48%, less than half, number seven. Phoenix, less than half, 47%. Los Angeles, less than half, 46%. New York, less than half, 40%. Washington, D.C., less than half, 34%. Only a third. 1 year ago, the lowest on that list was 57%. That should scare folks. This is exactly the same kind of trend we saw when things went nuts the first time, right? The whole market doesn't get hit in one go. It starts somewhere and grows from there. That's what we're seeing here. We are seeing segments of the marketplace that are not increasing in value over the course of a year, and that footprint's increasing, right? The footprint of homes that are rising per year is shrinking. See, then that should scare you. That should scare you. It's an indicator of bad things. And I've mentioned before, I'm in the market. I'm out there shopping, not just for my clients. I'm out there shopping for myself. And I've got a great lender that I work with. And every once in a while, she'll poke me with a stick and say, "Hey, what's going on? Let's move forward with some of this stuff." And I'm kind of sitting back saying, I think we may be in for something. I think jumping in and paying what a lot of these folks want me to pay doesn't make sense at the current moment. So I'm still, just as I said before, persistence pays. Keep going out there and seeing if you find something. You find a good deal, make an offer on it. It doesn't cost you anything to make an offer. And it doesn't cost you anything to say no if they counter it at a higher price. So I think – and I still stick by what I suggested. Ideals can actually still be found out there. It's just harder. But I think as we get further into this, it may just get a little easier. There's a lot of interesting data on this. If you go out and you do a Google search on just about anything relating to housing, house price declines, 2015, second housing bubble, those types of searches, you're going to find an awful lot of information out there if you want to do your own research. And I absolutely encourage you to do that. But it's absolutely food for thought. And I share this with my clients. I realize it's probably the dumbest thing for a guy whose job it is to sell houses to tell his clients, you know, I'm not sure where the market's going to go. All I can really say is I'll try to help you buy as smartly as possible. But I'm sure a lot of folks will draw a lot of comfort from that. Let that bounce around in your head. I'd love to get some feedback from you. What do you think? Do you think I'm completely off my nut? Do you think that I'm close but not quite right? Share your thoughts. If you've got other pieces of information that you think feed into this discussion, I'd sure love to see them. So just send those links to me. You can find information to contact me at www.therebelbroker.com. There should be a place to contact the Rebel Broker right there. You can send a message right to me. If you don't want to ask me about this particular issue, but you would like to offer one of your personal stories, remember, I'm still hot to hear all of your personal stories, failures, and successes relating to whatever you're doing. The bottom line is that anybody who's out there working to try and achieve their goals is going to have strategies and methods that everyone can benefit from and lessons to learn from failures that everyone can learn from. Whether you're someone who's building a construction company up from the ground up, or you dig ditches for a living, or you're a party planner, whatever, you know, we're all kind of heading towards the Quan, or what our ultimate end goal is for achieving some financial freedom in our lives. And I think those lessons translate across the board. So I'd love to hear those. I'd love to share them here on the show with others. So get in contact with me through therebelbroker.com if you'd like to share those. Thanks for listening, folks. I hope you're able to sleep and that these thoughts don't keep you awake tonight as I post this at around 10:30 this evening. I will talk to you all tomorrow, and I hope you have a good one.